You're listening to Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams, and we are at the Utah Rural Summit in Cedar City and talking today about tourism, the impact of tourism and other economic factors with Maria Twitchell, Executive Director of Cedar City Bryan Head Tourism Bureau. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And we're also talking with Lee Vonderesh, Managing Director of Utah Office of Tourism. Thanks.
Happy to be here with Maria.
Yeah.
My partner in tourism in the state.
Our partner in crime, I guess.
That's right.
I just got this, somebody from the Cedar City Arts Council handed me this arts and economic prosperity study. And I don't know if this would be typical, but it's pretty pretty impressive, the money generated by arts and culture.
Yeah. In Cedar City, Iron County, the arts is a major factor in terms of our tourism. It generates quite a bit of money, and we're grateful to have an arts council that went out and did this arts and economic prosperity study. And it basically found that it generates jobs, the arts generate jobs, and they generate revenues for our local government and our state government. And produces sales, the things people shop, people dine. And so we're excited to hear about that. Just basically over 1,000 jobs are generated by the arts and tourism here in Iron County.
Some $42 million, if I remember the number correctly. This is not only jobs for people directly in arts industry, but you have a secondary and beyond that effect, just to say nothing of the tourists who come in.
Yeah. So it's a domino effect. Mm-hmm. So it starts with those that come in probably to produce the arts, and then it goes down all the way to the person that serves the dinner and greets the person at the hotel desk.
Yeah. And this, for example, the Utah Shakespeare Festival, of course, this has been established over many years, but this is many months out of the year that this is ongoing.
Absolutely. Right? I mean, you know when the Shakespeare Festival is going on in Cedar City. It's just their people are here. They're dining, they're shopping, and they're enjoying the show. So it is our major season, part of the season. It's the summer. It runs for 10 weeks in the summertime, and then another 6 weeks in the fall. And our businesses know. They know when it's when the festival is on.
Mm. Lee Vonderesh, is this something? Of course, Utah Shakespeare Festival was started many years ago. A visionary leadership there, and of course it's
absolutely
grown into something tremendous. Is this replicable other places in Utah, do you think?
Oh, I think it is, and I think it is being replicated. I mean, kudos to Fred Adams. I mean, he's clearly a state treasure, and the Shakespeare Festival in the state. Interesting that you should raise the issue, Tom, because we're sitting at the Governor's Rural Summit of Southern Utah, and you have a speaker speaking about what cities are doing for boom towns, what towns did to turn themselves around. And clearly, he was talking about the creative economy being one of the strongest things that local towns can use to turn around their economic development opportunities.
That's Jack Schultz that you're making reference to. We talked to him on Access Utah on Thursday. What are some of the other things that you are encouraging towns and areas to do? Of course, develop their arts. What other things could be done?
Well, two of the things that we're seeing, and I'm speaking at lunch about what's unique in the world and what's unique in Utah, is authenticity and what is unique and what is actually weird and quirky about your area. So while you may not have a Shakespeare festival, you certainly may have something that you want to celebrate that's a little bit different. Now, I'm not suggesting it's weird, but hats off to Green River, Utah and Melon Days.
Yes.
I mean, they've taken something that is intrinsically theirs, they own it, and they've created events around it. And as a result, they get a lot of visitors. Escalante, Utah. Everett Roos spent a lot of time in Escalante. They kind of owned Everett Roos, created the Everett Roos celebration, if you will, and the Escalante Arts Festival, Boulder Heritage Festival, which capitalizes on the artisans and sheepherders and ranchers of that area. And in northern Utah, hats off to Julie Hollis. She's got a culinary tourism trail that it's marching its way towards a little Napa Valley up there. Maybe not with wine, but certainly with cheese and other things that are being created. So that's what we're seeing around the state, and that shows a very creative economy, not just for arts, but creative use of agritourism, as we say.
So in some of these areas, they have the, you know, the whatever it is, the sauerkraut days in Providence. And so during those times, you might get a bump. Can some of these ideas be leveraged year-round?
I certainly do think they can be leveraged year-round. I think Cedar City, again, is leading the way. The Shakespeare Festival was a limited basis, not so many weeks. And now it stretches from the 1st of July into October. And if they're successful in building the new theater, they'll have all kinds of options. The Moab Music Festival was one of the first things that was done down there. Very, very big event now in September. But now you have the Moab Folk Festival, and you have the Moab Bluegrass celebration. So communities that plant their flag in the ground, like Cedar City, which became Festival City USA, but pick what they're good at, what can be theirs, or create something, are the ones that are finding success year-round.
Turn back to Maria Twitchell with the Cedar City Bryan Head Tourism Bureau. So now you've added on to Utah Shakespeare Festival. You have the Summer Games and some other things sort of along the same theme.
Yeah, we've even added another theater festival. We now have the Neil Simon Festival, which runs 6 weeks out of the year. And so you can see that we've taken this whole performing arts aspect and have, you know, have spurred more and more people to try to create more festivals revolving around that. We have the Groove Fest Festival, which is 5 days of free music, you know, great American music, that is in the Main Street Park, and it brings 40,000 people into our community. So we know that events are really, truly the thing that keeps us going and is what we're best at, and that's where we put a lot of our resources. It's the events.
Tom, if I may, another good example is a neighbor of Cedar City, which kind of planted their flag for good health, healthy activity, and sports, and that would be St. George. Years ago, you knew St. George perhaps for its marathon in the fall, but you didn't know it for Huntsman Games, which you do now, and you didn't know it for the Ironman, which you do now. And if you look at the Red Rock Trail Golf Course and the trails that they have built up over the years, they really have kind of planted their flag in the ground for the sporting activities.
What does it take to coordinate this? Obviously, you have a visionary like Fred Adams, says we're going to have a Shakespeare Festival here, and then you kind of build on the theme. For example, Maria Twitchell, somebody has an idea. Where do they go? They go through a central clearinghouse like your bureau? Or?
Well, they certainly come to their civic leadership, you know, their city, their county. And, you know, here in Cedar City and in Iron County, we provide seed money, and we help them get their event going. And then hopefully it can continue to go. We have resources. Many of our cities, you know, we have 3 cities in our county. They all have event coordinators. You know, that's pretty amazing. We only have 42,000 people in our county. So, and then we have full-time event coordinators. So those are the resources that they can come to. There's resources with the state of Utah. We have a wonderful program through the Cooperative Promotions marketing program there, where they can submit an application and get some funds to help them market outside of the state and bring more dollars into the state. So the resources are there. I would say start with your county tourism office or your city event planner and then go from there.
You're quoting this press release from the City Arts Council. We quoted some statistics from this study. A lot of money comes in through arts. You're talking about differentiating cultural tourism versus windshield tourism. Maybe talk a bit about that.
Well, windshield tourism is, you know, kind of what we remember from the 70s and the 80s when you just came into a community on vacation, you snapped a picture, and you left. And nowadays, you know, cultural or whatever the tourism, I think it's more about the experience. And that's the kind of tourism that we want. We want them to come into our communities. We want them to experience our communities and what we have to offer, and to stay longer and spend their dollars. So our job is to help people, help our resources, create that experience, that culture, so that when people come here, they want to stay, they want to experience it, they want to go back and tell their friends and family.
And a lot more money spent.
And a lot more money spent.
Yeah. Lee Bondaresh, there's a lot of competition. You know, it's you see ads for Utah versus Colorado or whatever. Everybody's trying to get tourists to their area. How do you win that battle?
Well, you have the better product. I mean, you know, Utah was just named livability, and not to take anything away from our competitive set around here, but I think it. You know, we're number one in jobs. In careers from economic development side, we've just been named by Gallup as the most livable state in the country. All of that feeds onto the tourism marketing that we do. I think our product is unmatched. I mean, there is no state that can plant their flag on five national parks with the proximity of ours. There's only, I think, one other state that even has five national parks. We own the greatest snow on earth. Whether or not it's Brian Head, north to Beaver, and all the resorts in between. We have the greatest snow on earth. You talked about windshield versus cultural tourism. I just saw a presentation, and there are really three stages to promoting tourism. There's promoting the seeing with the beautiful scenery. There's the promoting the doing, which, of course, Shakespeare Festival. But really, the third one, which gets you the repeat customer, and I think Cedar City's done a good job at this, is the connecting. And that's where your people come into play, because they don't just remember the hotel, they remember the front desk. They don't just remember the event, they remember the volunteers around it. So the hospitality, and we saw this during the Olympics, the venues, brilliant in Utah. The people, the volunteers, were the lasting memory as well as the Olympics themselves. So we just go hand in hand with our partners to encourage from the top, certainly from a promotion standpoint. But when it comes to delivering the product, it's people like Maria Twitchell who are sitting next to me that work with the local communities and say, this is what really makes Utah life elevated. Just exactly what you're doing today, whether or not it's a county fair or a music festival or Shakespeare.
I've heard some people say as they try to fit tourism into other economic development ideas, saying that perhaps we shouldn't emphasize tourism as much and we ought to get, you know, higher paying jobs and get economic development that brings in more money. I wonder what you say to that.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. I can appreciate the fact that people want to boost the wage level, and we should be working towards that and making livable wage. One of the things I think that are great about tourism jobs is it offers those who are unskilled and trying to get an education, an opportunity. I'm sitting across you as someone that waitressed and worked in the hotel industry to pay their way through college. Had I not had the tourism industry to offer me a job, I don't know that I could have paid for college the way that I did. And I think there are a lot of kids, particularly down here at SUU, that take advantage of that. I would point out, though, Tom, that when our economy was shakiest in this country from 2009 to 2010, 8 to 10, we had over $1 billion spent in this state with five-star brands that knew something was happening in Utah and created hundreds of construction jobs for 3 years. Amon Geary, five-star in Big Water, Utah, the Waldorf Astoria in Park City, the Montage in Park City. So, and there were other properties. So those are owners stepping up and saying, I want to build something in this state. And it could have been a Hamptons in Richfield because one was built during the same time. People forget that there are billions of dollars in tourism-related infrastructure in this state. And it's quality of life, which tourism emphasizes, and the infrastructure that brings the Olympics, that brings businessmen for events, that brings meetings and conventions for people who may wish to relocate their company.
Mm-hmm. Rue Twitchell, what's next? What's on the? Is there anything on the drawing board? You got the Shakespeare Festival, Summer Games, Neil Simon. I don't know if there's anything, any ideas in the blueprint stage?
Oh, yeah, there's lots of ideas out there. Really, right now, we're concentrating on actually helping the Shakespeare Festival. They're trying to build their new, I guess you want to call it the Center of Arts. And in conjunction with that, that they're – well, they want to build this brand new theater because, you know, the Adams Theater is kind of getting up in age, and we want to make sure that we're providing a great theater experience. So we're trying to help them get some funding to get that that built within the next couple of years. There's a museum, Southern Utah Museum of Art, that we're also in the process of fundraising for, that will feature the paintings of Jim Jones, who, you know, nationally known artist of the national parks, who actually ended up residing here in Southern Utah. He was born here, but he ended up staying here most of his life. And so now we'll have this beautiful facility that will house his beautiful works for everyone to see. And, you know, having that center of arts is going to, you know, have a major impact on our community, bringing more people here year-round rather than just, the 16 weeks out of the year that we have the Shakespeare Festival.
And I guess the year-round part that Brian had would come into that.
Absolutely.
Right, on the off-season for the Shakespeare Festival. Anything else either of you would like to say on the subject?
Well, we're coming into fall, and I picking your favorite season in Utah is like picking your favorite child, which I, you know, certainly as managing director of the Office of Tourism for the state wouldn't do. But I would just encourage listeners to get out and see Utah. There's so much to do, and we get a little lulled and complacent. Mm-hmm. Maria and I were talking about it. Sometimes the northern people don't get away from Bear Lake and head on down to Cedar City, and sometimes the Cedar City people don't say, hey, let's go to Park City for the weekend. It's all very close and very inexpensive. There's great travel value in the state for families and lots of things to do. Go to visitutah.com. Find out what events are happening around the state, wherever you'd like to go, culinary tourism, music, folk, heritage. Get out and see our state museums, Iron County Museum here.
Yeah, we have
absolutely
Frontier
fantastic.
Homestead.
The Frontier Homestead. Fremont Museum is very mm-hmm. close by to Cedar City. Get out and see our state parks. They rival national parks in other areas. So plenty to do. Fall's a great time to get out and enjoy Utah.
It's Visit Utah.
VisitUtah.com for all your travel information.
All right. We've been talking with Lee Bondaresh, Managing Director of the Utah Office of Tourism. Thank you so much. And Maria Twitchell, Executive Director of Cedar City, Brian Head, Tourism Bureau. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Who says staying fit can't be fun? Get on your way to a healthier, sweeter life on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health. You'll get great tips for healthy living, like this recipe for
zesty turkey rolls.
We always have a great time, so will you on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International.
Friday morning at 10 here on Utah Public Radio.
Utah writer Gina Wickwar.
The latest issue of one of the news magazines we get had something about the pitching style of President Obama, comparing it to former President Bush's. I Googled both and scored a couple of YouTube hits. Mr. Obama, tossing out his ceremonial first pitch at a Nationals game back in April of 2010, did a fairly good job. But I have to admit, Mr. Bush's first pitch back at a Yankees game in 2001 was better. This stands to reason since Mr. Bush once owned a baseball team, and I suspect Mr. Obama's teen years were more likely spent on a surfboard than in the sandlots of Hawaii. No word, however, was written about the president's current challenger, Mr. Romney, though as the father of five boys, I think he'd have a pretty good arm. All this reminded me of my childhood passion for baseball. My father, son of Flatbush, was naturally enough a Dodgers fan. He even took me to several games at Ebbets Field, which I can still remember, if barely. But I do vividly recall the day I saw Jackie Robinson play. We'd just returned home from 2 years in Japan, where my father had served in General MacArthur's occupied army. My father, an ardent champion of civil rights, rushed to Ebbets Field and the Dodgers as fast as he could to get a glimpse of this great man, who had only recently been allowed to play in the White Leagues. I also recall other great players like Gil Hodges, Pee Wee Reese, and Roy Campanella, another black player. Pitching was my special talent in those pre-teenage years. It took me a while to really believe that as a girl I had no chance of becoming a major league pitcher. There was a women's league, but that didn't count in my mind. I wanted to play with the big boys. Knowing my passion, my father, summer evenings after supper, would grab his mitt and a ball, toss me my mitt, and we'd go outdoors where he'd throw me pitch after pitch, high ones, low ones, curve ones, all hard. I would catch them, gritting my teeth when my hand stung like crazy inside the mitt, and return each of them hard. The greatest praise my dad could give me was that I threw like a boy. We both knew what that meant. It meant your arm didn't come up over your head like a ballerina, and your hand didn't curl downward for the throw. Most girls had a habit of doing that. I observed this and vowed I would study the boys. Of course, is what we'd call today sexist, but I wasn't the only girl who took pride in her throws. There were other girls who could throw a ball just like a boy. We knew who we were, and we were the ones picked when the boys formed their teams. Somewhere, about age 14, things changed. I realized I didn't want to be known as the girl with the golden arm anymore. I was suddenly embarrassed that I could throw like Preacher Rowe, catch like Roy Campanella, and hit like Duke Snyder. I began to demur when the boys in junior high asked me to be on their team. I grew self-conscious about being considered one of the guys. My father noticed. "Where's my baseball player?" he'd ask, and I would mumble something and go to my room. I had, alas, discovered boys, which meant it had dawned on me that if I were as good as, or, heaven forbid, better than my boy pals at baseball, I would never, ever have a boyfriend. Times have changed, thankfully, and I suspect very few young women today give a thought that their physical prowess on the baseball diamond will turn away a potential suitor. But it was thus so in the late 1950s, at least for me and my teenage female peers. That would all change in just a very few short years, but we, at that point in time, were as trapped by our chromosomes as Jackie Robinson had been by the color of his skin. This is Gina Wickwar.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by USU's Anthropology Museum in Old Main. It's free Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, Saturdays 10 to 4. This Saturday is an exploration of archaeology in the Intermountain West. Information is at anthromuseum.usu.edu.
We turn to science today. There's an article in the journal Science, which how the natural world is affected by continuing climate change, specifically bridging the gap that has existed between the fields of ecology and evolution, disciplines which usually have been treated separately. And specifically, a team of scientists has developed a breakthrough method to predict the impact of environmental change on wildlife. They tested out this methodology on the Yellowstone wolves. We're going to talk about this, rapid evolution within species, and how environmental change and climate change affects that evolutionary change with the two members of that team. The lead author of the paper is Tim Coulson of Imperial College London. Professor Coulson joins us, I believe, from London. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom.
Appreciate you taking the time to be with us. Understand from Professor McNulty here in studio, it's about 4 p.m. your time.
That's right, 4 p.m. my time. I think it's energy breakfast time at your end, I believe.
Yes, it is. I didn't know the gap, and I was hoping we hadn't got you up in the middle of the night, so I'm grateful it's afternoon. We have with us in studio Dan McNulty, who is a Utah State University wildlife ecologist. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tom.
So let's start with you, Professor Coulson. This is being labeled a breakthrough methodology. Professor McNulty tells me that usually these two fields have been treated separately, at least the methodology used, ecology and evolution. How is this different, this new methodology?
So that's right. Traditionally, population ecologists or ecologists have focused on things like population size, so the number of individuals alive in a population at any point in time, and how that changes from one year to the next. In contrast, evolutionary biologists have focused on genes and attributes of individuals, so things like coat color in the wolves or body size that are influenced by genes. And the evolutionary biologists would ignore population size, and the population ecologists would ignore the genetics and these attributes of individuals. And we've worked out a way in which we can look at these things together, and we're hoping that's going to bias a little bit more ability to predict responses.
So Professor McNulty, just expanding on that, so you join the look at the gene mutations with the overall population size increasing and decreasing.
That's correct.
Look at it all together.
That's right. Yep.
So can you give examples of, we were talking before we went on the air, so I know you can, of fast evolution. We think of evolution as happening over a long period of time. But you were giving me some examples of very quick evolution.
Right. So in terms of the impact of climate change causing rapid evolution, there's a well-worked-out example with Galapagos ground finches, where in wet years you have small beak sizes because the seeds are small in those wet years, whereas in dry years the seeds are large and that selects for a larger beak size. So that's one of the best examples of rapid evolution in response to climate change.
Also, you were telling me about bighorn rams, bighorn sheep.
That's right. So environmental change can come in lots of different flavors. Both climate warming is one example, but also human harvest hunting. And there's a well-worked example of hunting, the impacts of hunting on bighorn sheep in Alberta, where they found that intensive harvesting over about a 30-year period led to smaller horn size and body size in trophy rams. Mm.
So not just overall population, which you could see would be affected.
That's
by
right.
Trophy hunting, but also the way the sheep are.
That's correct, right. So that's what Tim's saying, is in terms of the attributes of the individuals will change over a very short period of time.
That would have application, I would imagine, for wildlife managers in Utah.
Certainly, if we're managing for trophy hunting, big game trophy hunting, we want to be sensitive for the impact of harvest on those attributes that hunters are interested in. Hmm.
Professor Colson, do you have examples you could give us of the same area of rapid evolutionary change?
Yeah, there's a growing number, actually. So in various birds, small bird species that we see over in the UK, we've seen rapid changes in behavior. So how birds are foraging for food, for example, when climate changes. And we've seen examples from a wild population of sheep living off the coast of Scotland, where population size has been increasing and the sheep have actually been getting smaller.
Hmm. I pulled up an article, your studies on the sheep, and I had made the connection with now the studies on wolves. I don't know if anybody else had made that connection. So let's talk about the Yellowstone wolves. Just in general, maybe starting with Professor McNulty on this one, have we noticed, you know, just going in, any changes over the past little while in that population?
Well, it's a new population, right? It's only about 16 years old. It was reintroduced starting in 1995, ending in 1997, and the period in which we studied them in terms of the data collection was 1998 to 2009, about 11-year period. Within that period, there were definitely changes in population size, but the frequency of coat color in the population, however, did not change. So on average, there are about 50% black, 50% gray. There were changes, annual changes in average body size. Some years, wolves were on average bigger than other years, but those were changes that were likely in response to environmental factors, food availability, competition amongst wolves, and not necessarily an evolutionary change.
Mm-hmm. Professor Colson, I understand that wolves were deemed to be a good species to test this methodology on because they're at the top of the food chain in that area. They're a top predator.
That's right. So what we wanted to do was to work with a species where data can be collected, so survival rates of individuals of known coat color and known body size and fertility rates and things like that. We wanted to do it for a population where data are collected that are similar to data that are now collected on a large number of species. And so the Yellowstone wolves is a great example because there's some good, you can recognize many individuals, several individuals are radio collared, and you can follow them throughout their lives. And that's a long-term study, but there's a growing number of studies where people are using the same methodology. So we wanted to be able to demonstrate that the method that we had developed could be applied to a species that although the species are unusual, the type of data that are collected from the Yellowstone wolves is no longer as unusual as it was when the studies started. So in other words, because we can apply it on the wolves, we're hoping that lots of other people working on species ranging from insects right the way through to perhaps things like elephants in Africa will be able to use our methodology. And in time, I think we've taken a sort of first step on a journey of showing how this can be done. And in time, we're hoping the methods will be applied across a wide range of species. And maybe we'll get to a point when we can say some very general things about how species are expected to respond to environmental change, including climate change.
If you just joined us, we're talking about science. In fact, this is an article that appeared in the edition of the journal Science. A team of researchers has made a breakthrough in developing a method which can improve predictions of wildlife responses to environmental changes. They studied, tested this out on the Yellowstone wolves. We have with us the lead author, Tim Colson from Imperial College London, and Dan McNulty with USU. He's a wildlife ecologist. I guess another reason, in expanding on what Professor Colson said, Professor McNulty, that another reason that the wolves were deemed a good species to test this methodology on was the extensive data on the wolves. Professor Colson talked about that. Could you tell us about the Yellowstone Wolf Project?
Well, the Yellowstone Wolf Project is a long-term project that started in 1995, tracking the population of wolves that was reintroduced and tracking the fates of individuals. So on average, every year we have about 30 or so individuals that are radio collared, and we follow them intensively. And so we have very detailed information on the fates of individuals and their behavior, their hunting success, their social behavior, interactions with other wolves, other packs. And so it's perhaps one of the most highly resolved studies, certainly of a large carnivore and perhaps a large mammal in terms of the wide range of data that we're actually collecting on this population over a very long, well, 16 years, but we intend for this to carry on well into the future.
And I guess that's another advantage. You know when this population started. You were there from the beginning in terms of studying them.
That's right. So so we have a very clear starting point that's key, and we continue to, we plan to continue this into the future. And really, in order to evaluate the impact of environmental change on a population, what is absolutely critical are long-term data. And that can be difficult in this sort of environment where funding for long-term research is difficult to come by. It's expensive. And yet we absolutely need these sorts of data in order to answer these critical questions of how environmental change and climate change is going to be impacting wildlife populations.
Hmm. Professor Colson, what if you talk to us a little bit about the method you developed? It's been described as a breakthrough method. I read in the abstract to the article that accurate predictions may be elusive, but you can predict in general terms, can you, the evolutionary impact of climate change?
What I think we've been able to do is come up with a method that shows biologists how this can be done. So how you can simultaneously understand the dynamics of population size and how species will adapt to climate change. However, there are several components to the model, so several little bits that go into our mathematical model, and they're to do with how the attributes that you're looking at. We looked at coat color and body size. We need to understand how they influence survival and reproduction and the growth rates of individual wolves and the sizes of the offspring that they produce. And climate change could influence any one of those bits of the model, or in fact any type of environmental change could influence bits of the model. And in order to work out how climate or the arrival of a new prey species or a disease, how it influences each component, so each part of the model, really needs a lot of data. So the reason that we think that it may, at the moment, we've shown how it can be done, hopefully in a few years' time, we will be able to actually come up with better predictions or predictions that we'd be prepared to put a little bit more faith in, because we'll have hopefully have got enough data where we can say, okay, well, look, we've now had several years of say, deep snowfall, large amounts of snow, several years of small amounts of snow, and then we'll be able to sort of link the weather itself to the model. At the moment, we've just treated the environment as coming in good or bad or intermediate years. Our next step is to work out what are the factors that make a good intermediate or bad year for wolves. And we know a little bit about what those things are going to be. It's going to be the amount of food, so the amount of elk and bison. It's going to be the amount of snow that is falling during the winter and how long that snow's on the ground. It's going to be the prevalence of disease. It's going to be the amount of management that's going on wolves. It's going to be the number of other carnivore species living within the same area as the wolves. And at the moment, we know, or we have a suspicion that several of those things will be important, but at the moment, we can't actually work out how the contribution of each one of those things. So is the one thing we should be focusing on, like the amount of snow or the amount of food, or do we need to know information on all of those things? And until we've got those data, we can't answer that. So we've really kind of said to the biologists out there, it's kind of look what we can do now, and anyone can do this, but if you're going to make accurate predictions, so if you wanted me to tell you what is going to happen to wolves over the next 10 years, I can't do that now, but maybe when we've got some more data in a few years' time, I'll be prepared to come on the radio and give you some firmer predictions about exactly what will happen to the wolves.
Very good. We'll schedule that. Professor McNulty, I wonder if you could expand on that. What data do we still need?
Well, right now, what's really interesting that's going on in northern Yellowstone is a switch in the composition of the prey community. Elk numbers have declined since 1994, just starting the year prior to the reintroduction, and have continued to decrease. Meanwhile, bison numbers have started to increase. And we're really interested in how that's going to affect the survival and dynamics of the wolf population. And so tracking those effects is one of the things that we plan to do going forward, and looking at how the rate at which wolves are killing elk and the rate at which they're killing bison, how does that influence their survival and reproduction?
Now, Professor Colson, earlier you said that your hope is that this methodology can be applied by other scientists to many other species, birds and insects and the like. How fast do you think that could happen?
There are several groups around the world who are using the type of approach that we've developed. So, I mean, we're not the only people working in this area. And I'm aware of studies that are going on experimental systems in laboratories where people are looking at what are known as bulb mites. So these are very small invertebrates that can cause pests to things like onions and garlic and tulips and what have you. Right the way through to a group over in Stanford who is actually looking at the effects of changing obesity levels in people on survival rates and mortality rates and fertility rates in human populations. And they are hoping to be able to ask questions about how increasing levels of ability might impact life expectancy as well as human population growth into the future. In terms of the wildlife side of this, there's a group up in Canada who are interested in applying these methods to bighorn sheep, and there's also several groups based over in the UK who are applying these methods to plants. So it's kind of early days yet, but the number of species that people are looking at is fairly diverse, and in a few years' time, hopefully we'll be able to pull some generalities together across these species.
Myers perked up on you mentioned studies about humans, for obvious reasons. So I guess there are studies already happening. Could this methodology be applied in a more specific way we look at environmental change and then how that would affect, as you said, not only population size, but lifespan?
Absolutely. So, and you know, within people, it will be the amount, you know, the amount of food that they're eating, so calories and diet, or the amount of exercise they're taking or not, and these sorts of things. And that's an area, obviously, that there's been quite a lot of interest in from, you know, the medical community. And my colleagues at Stanford who are doing this are using some data from a long-term study of people over somewhere on the east coast of the U.S., a place called Framingham. I can't remember which state it's in.
I think it's in Massachusetts, yeah.
Yeah, so they're working on that at the moment, and I expect within, you know, the next few months there will be some information available on how changing diets and changing levels of exercise and the way we live our lives is leading through to impact on aspects of human longevity and what have you. Mm.
Professor McNulty, you've mentioned, and Professor Goldson as well, some specific examples, species, where evolutionary change is quite rapid. You're trying to look at the interaction of environmental changes to these evolutionary changes. In general, are evolutionary changes in many species speeding up, do you think, staying at a constant rate?
Well, it's hard to say. I think that evolution has always been a rapid process at times, as well as a slow process also at times. I think what's changed really is our appreciation for how it can be rapid, and most particularly how rapid evolution impacts populations in ecological time. I think that's the real thing that's changed in terms of our understanding is – you know, given that we see these examples of rapid evolution in nature, the question now is how do those rapid evolutionary changes impact a population in ecological time? How do we measure that? How do we account for those changes? And that's the exciting thing about this approach that we've developed is that it's now a quantitative tool for evaluating how the feedbacks between evolution and ecology that are occurring at the same time.
Mm. Professor Coulson, is it your hope that perhaps this would be a catalyst for more interaction between those two fields of science, evolution and ecology?
Oh, I really hope so. I think that would be very exciting if that were the case. And I hope that our study will appeal to both ecologists and to evolutionary biologists, and they will realize how that it is relatively straightforward to use these methods that we've been developing, and that they will go out and do so. So that's my hope, but only time will tell. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, sometimes these walls do develop that are, as you look at them, artificial.
That's right, and I think it's sort of partly just historical, and the two fields developed along different lines, and though for a long time people realized that evolutionary change often occurred after there had been some big shift in the ecology of a system. It was only relatively recently when people started to notice that characters or attributes of individuals that were determined by genes could change quite quickly. And at that point, several people started saying we need to work together, and we need to link ecology and evolution together. And as I said before, several groups have been working on this, and there's been a huge amount of important work that's gone before, and we were able to build on that a little bit and have come up with this method, which hopefully will provide more and more insight as the years go by. That's our dream.
If you just joined us, we are talking with Tim Coulson, who is with Imperial College London, and with Dan McNulty, USU wildlife ecologist. They're part of a team that has developed a method which can help improve predictions of wildlife responses to environmental changes in various ecosystems, and they studied specifically the Yellowstone wolves. Let me ask you about what each of you has going apart from this study. But Professor McNulty, what sorts of studies are you involved in?
Well, I'm intimately involved in the study of wolf ungulate dynamics in Yellowstone National Park. And so one of the things that we're interested in doing is modeling the impact of changes in the prey populations, incorporating those changes into this modeling framework that we've developed. And so one of the things that we're doing is coming up with better methods and better insight into the impact of fluctuations in elk population size on wolf survival and reproduction. So as Tim mentioned, developing a better understanding of what constitutes environmental change. And so one of the main changes that we think is involved here in terms of influencing wolf dynamics are changes in the numbers of prey, primarily bison and elk. And going back to the elk-bison thing, bison are a much larger, much more difficult prey for wolves to kill. And body size is a very important attribute that allows wolves to successfully kill. The bigger the wolf, the more likely they are to make a kill. And so it is possible that as the prey as the composition of the prey community switches, if it continues to switch towards bison, it is possible that wolves may on average grow larger as a result of the selective advantage of being bigger when it comes to killing bison. And in fact, some of the largest wolves that we've recorded in Yellowstone are those wolves that primarily hunt bison in the wintertime. So there's a bit of some anecdotal support for that hypothesis.
I had known that wolves do prey on bison?
Absolutely, absolutely, and increasingly so, particularly in the interior of the park in the wintertime, because the elk migrate to lower elevations. So the only prey that are available, large prey, in winter in the interior of Yellowstone are bison.
So you would have to be big, a big wolf, too.
Absolutely.
Even though the wolves, as I understand it, hunt in packs.
They
right?
They do hunt in packs. However, the extent to which they actually cooperate as a group in bringing down prey is not as much as we might think it is. In interactions with elk, what we found is that the benefit of group size in terms of improving hunting success actually reaches a plateau at around four wolves. So packs larger than four actually don't realize any benefit in terms of improved hunting success. And I suspect that that's, you know, it's probably a bit the influence of group size on hunting success is bigger or greater with bison, but still more wolves isn't necessarily going to solve the problem in terms of taking down bison. Individual body size is also going to be an important attribute.
Mm-hmm. And that's a whole other topic of study, which I'm sure has been studied extensively, and that is the interaction, the dynamics, the social dynamics among wolves. That's mm-hmm. a very mm-hmm. interesting topic. So this involves you, I would imagine, in getting out into Yellowstone, which must be a burden to you, and it must be a hard thing.
Well, now that I'm in Logan, it's only about 4 hours or so to the boundary of West Yellowstone.
Yes.
Whereas when I was in Minneapolis, it was about 12 or 14 hours to the northern end. So it's a much shorter trip.
Yeah, much shorter trip. You were studying Yellowstone wolves when you were in Minneapolis.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this is a lot nicer now. Yeah. Professor Colson, same question. What studies do you have ongoing apart from this one?
So we're continuing to develop this theory and work out ways in which we can analyze the models and applying it to populations of red deer, which is similar to your elk, right the way through, and also to some rodent populations. But one of the other parts of research that we're doing over here at the moment is trying to develop high-tech methods to actually collect data remotely on a range of wildlife species. So over here in the UK, we have a study of mice at the moment where we're using some technology we took from the military, which allows us to track individual animals in real time to an accuracy of about half a meter. So we can kind of, in the field, we can monitor where individuals are, or we're working towards being able to monitor exactly where they are, and if we have the habitat modeled in great detail. And once we've got this working for mice, we hope to be able to scale it up to larger animals. And then I'd be able to track where my PhD students are as well.
Good. Yes. I imagine there's some difficulties, an animal that size of mice. If you can do it with mice, you can do it with anything larger.
That's right. So we need to get – we're working with engineers to shrink down some of this technology at the moment. We need to get the whole the transmitters that we fix onto the mice down to 0.5 grams. So we're working with – electronical engineers who are experts in shrinking down devices. And we're getting there. So I'm kind of hopeful that that this is all going to work. We know it works in the laboratory. We need to trial it in the field. But as you say, if we can get this working for mice, we know it works for people. It's been used in the military to track soldiers. If we can do it on mice, we should be able to do it on pretty much anything in between. So I think that's kind of potentially exciting, and it should open up some species that are currently quite difficult to study in the field. And then, with any luck, we'll be able to use the data we can collect to link to the theory that we're developing. So that's the sort of that's the sort of work I'm involved with over here. I was chuckling when Dan there was saying that it was a bit of a trek for him to get to Yellowstone. It's even further from over here, and unfortunately, I don't get out to that as often as I'd like. Mainly because my wife puts a stop to it.
Yeah, but for you, it involves a plane ride and a long trip after you get off the plane.
Absolutely, and as you mentioned earlier, there's a 7-hour time difference. There's jet lag thrown in as well.
I want to go back. This technology that you're using, at least applying to the mice, this has been used to track soldiers?
That's right. So it's been used on the battlefield, and it was developed by the military. And it was a bit of good fortune that ended up talking to the people who developed some of the mathematical theory behind it, actually, and had a conversation with them, met up with them, and then said, do you think you'd be able to apply this to mice? And they said, yes, that should be no problem at all. And a little bit later in the conversation, it became apparent that these electrical engineers didn't have much of an idea how big a mouse was. But when we pointed out we'd need to get it shrunk down to half a gram, the guy we were talking to went and found an expert in miniaturizing technology. So there's now a group of engineers and a group of biologists working towards this. And it's great fun to work with engineers with a completely different set of skills to us.
Very interesting. We are out of time for this conversation, but we've been talking about a new methodology which can help improve predictions of wildlife responses, evolutionary responses to environmental changes in various ecosystems. The test case for the method was Yellowstone wolves. I've been talking with Tim Coulson from Imperial College London. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And in studio with us has been Dan McNulty, Utah State University Wildlife College. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much.
This is folk singer Michael Jonathan inviting you to tune in to the next broadcast of Wood Songs. We have two great artists, the Honeycutters and Granville Automatic.
Now I'm 21 and all I've got's my honor.
Both artists, music and conversation on the next broadcast of the Wood Songs, Old Time Radio.
Friday night at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
We'll head north on the next Putumayo World Music Hour and visit the largest French-speaking region outside of France itself, Quebec. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join me for Quebec, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Coming up on the next Bluegrass Breakdown, there are mood boosters, immune system strengtheners, appearance enhancers, and stress relievers. They're wildly contagious, confusing to approaching frowns, and are curves that set everything straight. I'm Dave Higgs, and with the help of the Grass Cats, Rhonda Vincent, and Bill Clifton, we'll be looking at high lonesome smiles on the next Bluegrass Breakdown.
Saturday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.